I'm walking through Bramble behind a suburban shopping center in Rybrook, New York. It's a sleepy town north of New York City, and I'm joined by the town's mayor, Paul Rosenberg. That water you hear? It's the Bowman Avenue Dam.
So, what's interesting about this dam?
Well, not very much, quite honestly. It's called a sluice gate, and what it does is the main part of the dam raises and lowers, and it will allow water to be metered out into the Long Island Sound. There's a computer program that measures the height of the water in the river and how much water is backing up behind the dam.
And yet, a few years back, the computer controls of this seemingly uninteresting dam were hacked.
The software that controls this dam is commonly used to control software in other more important dams around the country.
A team of people broke into these controls, and they weren't just some local troublemakers either. The Justice Department indicted 7 employees of a computer security firm that works with Iranian intelligence. But why target this dam?
I can't in my wildest dreams imagine why this dam was important to them. My thoughts were it was either one of two things. They were horribly misinformed, and they thought that by raising and controlling the dam that they were going to unleash some sort of Noah's Ark tidal wave, or they were practicing for something on a larger extent.
The government believes the attack was part of a bigger plot, a bigger hack, targeting at least 46 major financial companies and institutions such as J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America. The Justice Department publicly named the country and the individual attackers. The FBI put their names and photos on a wanted poster. But so-called naming and shaming isn't stopping such attacks from happening by Russia, China, or others. This episode is part of an ongoing series on the future of war. We look at state-sponsored code breaking, and we ask, what is an act of war in the digital age?
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
My name is Patrick Whedon, and I happen to be the curator of the National Cryptologic Museum, which is where we are right now.
We're in Fort Meade, Maryland, at a museum operated by the NSA.
This museum has been around since the early 90s, and it basically is about helping people to understand how important the making and breaking of codes has been really from the beginning of time.
We pass cipher devices from the 18th century and Cold War satellites. Then we reach one of the museum's most popular exhibits.
Right now, we're looking at an authentic German Enigma machine. This machine was a huge challenge to the Allies during World War II. It was the main tactical device that the armed forces of the Third Reich used to communicate in the battle space.
At first glance, the Enigma looks like a cross between a typewriter and an old-fashioned cash register, with keys, dials, and rotors.
This machine was originally a commercial device. It was meant to allow businesses and banks the ability to encrypt their commercial radio messages. It failed miserably because it was too costly. It went on the market in the 1920s for about $1,200. Officers of the Third Reich realized it could be a very valuable upgrade to how they communicated in the battle space, largely because it could produce permutations of 3 × 10^114. In the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, 3 × 10^114 is not a number that you can go through in any reasonable period of time. In fact, it's more than all the stars in the universe.
So the Nazis believed Enigma's codes were unbreakable and began relying on the machine to communicate sensitive information. And over the years, this story gained a lot of attention from Hollywood.
One of the more popular movies in this area is The Imitation Game.
Everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Mr. Turing, do you know how many died because of it?
Millions of people saw that movie, and millions of people thought it was great, and from any perspective, it was a big success. However, like many Hollywood movies, from an historical perspective, it has some egregious errors. Probably the most egregious is Alan Turing did not break the Enigma code. That was done by a group of Polish mathematicians. If you're on Jeopardy and someone asks you, what is the name of the country that broke the Enigma code? The answer is Poland.
And he says Enigma teaches us a valuable lesson on encryption.
Always be careful of that word impossible. When you're dealing with cryptologic challenges, someone says, don't worry, it'll never happen, it's impossible. Take a step back and ask them where the evidence is to back that up, because the Germans believe the machine that we demonstrated was perfect and flawless and could not be broken. And thankfully for the rest of humanity, they paid a very high price.
It's been more than half a century since World War II, and countries are still breaking each other's codes. Just recently, Chinese hackers stole hundreds of gigs of sensitive data from a U.S. Navy contractor. These days, instead of radio waves and analog encryption, governments are using bots, denial-of-service attacks, lots of malware, and also...
Oh, well, you know, your phone is your life nowadays, and hackers have realized that if they want to get access to your life, the phone is the gateway to that.
That's Robert McMillan. He covers computer security, hackers, and privacy for The Wall Street Journal. Computer security software giant McAfee estimates that 10% of mobile phones are infected with some kind of malicious software.
There's super juicy targets, right, because of all the data that's on them. And the people that love to hack the phone more than anyone else are governments who want to spy on people. They have the motive, means, and the opportunity, because your phone is sending location data to Google, and if location services are on, it's possible for you to actually recreate a map of everywhere you went that day. The phone is also this amazing computer that can do things like record audio. So if you get on the phone, you can start recording people's phone calls, record ambient audio when the phone's not even in use. So the scenarios of what can be done by getting access to the phone are pretty extreme. And so that's the reason why the governments are interested in this.
He says spies are increasingly hacking into smartphones of political opponents and dissidents around the world, giving them access to data far more sensitive than what most people keep on personal computers. And so types of hacking are changing. Our thoughts on what it means, those are changing too.
When somebody like reads your email, that's not warfare, that's espionage, right? But what we've seen in the last few years are what, you know, what they call kinetic attacks. We've seen the ability to really affect physical systems in the real world. We reported here at Journal on an attack in Saudi Arabia last year where they found code in a petrochemical plant that was designed to override the safety system. We do know that somebody spent a fair bit of effort to figure out how to get into this very obscure system that basically has one purpose, which is to shut down the plant when it gets into a dangerous situation. So it feels like we're getting closer to a situation where there could be loss of life or something that looks like warfare.
U.S. officials believe North Korea was behind a computer hacking attack on Sony Entertainment.
More than 21 million Americans had personal information stolen from government files. The information was hacked from the Office of Personnel Management, or OPM.
The FBI is now investigating the hack that led to the leak of Democratic National Committee emails.
I think that cyber capability increasingly is infused into every other element of our national power. We're connecting a billion things to the internet every quarter, and military systems aren't exempt from that.
Nate Fick is the CEO of the cybersecurity firm called Endgame. It provides services for the NSA and the Air Force, among others.
We're living in a world now where these cyber weapons are increasingly inexpensive and easy to develop. It doesn't take nation-state levels of research and development and money and talent to build them in the way that it does still to build a nuclear weapon. And their use is much easier to obscure.
Now, you've said there's a real deterrence failure in U.S. cybersecurity. What do you mean?
Since the end of World War II, I think that the edifice of American power in so many ways, in Europe, in the Pacific, has been built on the back of a deterrence strategy. We have extended deterrence to our allies in NATO, extended deterrence to Japan and South Korea, and said that an attack on them is an attack on us. And we've made that credible. Our adversaries really believe that we will use every element of our diplomatic, economic, informational, and if necessary, military power to defeat them. And the effect that has is it deters them, it dissuades them, and it means we haven't had a great power war since the end of World War II. Now, with more and more economic and diplomatic national competition happening in the cyber domain, look at what's happening. The Russians, the Chinese, our great power adversaries are doing things to us using cyber means that they would never do using kinetic means. And they do it because they know that we don't have a declaratory policy, an escalatory policy. We're not prepared to respond. And so they get away with it.
It remains really hard to pinpoint the source of cyber attacks and say with any certainty who's to blame. But even when attribution is clear, governments all over the globe are grappling with this question of how to respond.
let alone when to call an attack an act of war.
Part of the reason that people are struggling with that question in cyberspace is because we actually struggle with that question in the real world as well. And the truth is that even in the real world, it's not clearly defined what an act of war is.
Michael Daniels spent 4 years as the cybersecurity coordinator on the National Security Council staff. He was also President Obama's advisor on cybersecurity. He's given a lot of thought to these issues.
For example, the North Koreans actually captured a U.S. ship, the USS Pueblo, back in 1968. We did not treat that as if it was an act of war. Yet, by many definitions, you could make the argument that the capturing of a U.S. naval vessel should probably count as an act of war. So even in the physical world, what we count and consider to be an act of war is fluid, depending on the specifics of the geopolitical relationship between the two countries in question. And so it shouldn't be surprising that that also extends into cyberspace. But I think that the outlines of what people are really talking about are more clear than we realize, in the sense that an act of war is probably something that creates some sort of physical disruption in the real world. It's not just about the theft of information that could either be used for criminal purposes or for espionage. And it would probably have to be a fairly significant effect in the real world, not just a minor temporary blip.
Like others we spoke to in the course of this reporting, Daniel believes the analogies we currently use to compare cyber attacks with traditional or kinetic attacks generally don't add up.
First of all, in cyberspace, the bad guys don't launch malware like you launch a missile. They take time to do reconnaissance on networks. They will download the malware onto a network. And then at some point, they're going to send a command to execute the malware, whether it's ransomware or to steal the information. We're unlikely to be able to detect the launch of that command in the same way that we can detect a missile launch. The lag between that launch and impact is measured in milliseconds in cyberspace, not in minutes as it is with a missile. And finally, once it's launched, a missile actually has to obey the laws of physics, you know, as expressed through ballistics. And it's a really hard problem, but at least it's solvable. That's not how cyberspace works. You know, a malware command has lots of different potential paths to get there. So the differences are actually quite legion once you actually start looking at them. And so we keep trying to map our physical world analogies onto cyberspace, and most of them don't work very well.
We're also still trying to understand the physical mechanics of cyber attacks. What can be hacked? How can things be hacked? Defense contractor Raytheon operates a cyber range where theories about these questions can be tested. It's called the Code Center.
Most of the Code Center is going to be behind closed doors because what goes in to our cyber range for testing needs to be very carefully controlled. So let's go into the closed area and see what's here.
Bill Lair directs cyber programs at Raytheon for the Department of Defense. He takes me down a series of locked corridors into a glass-enclosed observation deck where they run war games and other capture-the-flag type tests.
And we have specific rules on how individual equipment gets signed in and out of the facility. Our external communications with even internet circuits are monitored. You can kind of hear in the background this dull roar of the data center. The data center really is the host for everything that happens in the code center. So it holds all of our software that we're going to test. If we're going to use any kind of malware, we're able to use the data center to host that malware in a secure environment. But if you're using real malware on a range like we do, you don't want it to get out into the wild and perhaps infect another system. So everything kind of gets driven from a very tight area here in the code center to be able to do that.
Software is full of liabilities. It's inherently complex, and it needs frequent changes and updates. And so cybersecurity experts will tell you it's kind of incredible we aren't hacked more often than we are. Here at the Code Center, they're able to test the security of all sorts of government systems, from the electronics used on military ships and planes to things like municipal power grids.
The deal with power grids, like everything else, they have software. And now that everything is interconnected, there is some vulnerability introduced. That's the fundamental issue. So the question with securing the power grids becomes, how can we put the right kind of security in, but still have the reliability and the safety that we need from our power system? The truth is, though, that everything that we have is probably starts in a physical piece of equipment. You see more and more today that descriptions that an automobile is really a computer on wheels. We've got to have a facility that's able to bring a hardware system in and think about the vulnerabilities in its systems as well. So this is
as we go about this tour, we visit rooms that keep signals out and rooms to keep them in. Inside these protected spaces, Layer's team can test how radio frequency bounces off things in the real world and explores what it means.
So, one more stop. These are anechoic chambers. Anechoic chambers are basically provide a pure RF environment, so when you're doing radio frequency testing, you can also understand if there are vulnerabilities there. So the everyday example of that is, you know, a hacker trying to get some access into your telephone or my cell phone, so we can also emulate these wireless environments and do it in a very controlled way with a chamber like this. So this is a huge door. It's, you know, probably weighs about 300 pounds, the door itself.
Something else besides our cell phones that run on wireless RF? Drones. There's a collection of quadcopters in front of me, the kind you can buy at the store. There's all sorts of signals they can gather off one of these, including location data, images, maybe a flight video.
When we use just basic commercial, you know, software analysis tools, you would find hundreds of vulnerabilities that a fairly low-skilled hacker would be able to take advantage of. So yeah, this is hacking of quadcopters.
Remember a couple of years ago when one of these went flying toward the White House? He says that's the kind of defensive scenario they're thinking about when doing this.
Someone else with an alternative controller and that joystick that he has in his hands would be fundamentally rendered inoperable, so wouldn't have control of it anymore. If you were doing it for nefarious reasons, you might take one that law enforcement's using to do something and crash it into the side of a building or something like that. In the way that we've talked about other things, that it's really software that makes that go, and understanding how that software was built.
But drones have been around for years. What about tech that isn't even on the market yet?
So a quantum computer theoretically has the ability to basically attack and break all of our major forms of encryption. I'm Sarah Castellanos. I'm a reporter for the Wall Street Journal's CIO Journal section, where we cover chief information officers and the world that they live in and the world they do business in. In the future, if a country or a company is able to actually get one of these quantum computers up and running, it could represent the future of hacking.
Fully functional quantum computing is probably several years out, but with it, we can expect quantum encryption and also quantum code breaking. By using the properties of quantum physics, these types of computers can sort through a vast number of possibilities within a fraction of a second. And this complicates the future of encryption, as well as how we exchange data on the internet.
RSA is a cryptographic algorithm that underlies most of the internet security that we have. It's basically one of two major algorithms that underlie our communication over the internet via email, the exchange of data, basically anything related to Internet of Things, devices. It's a very common algorithm that secures the internet.
Imagine RSA as the backbone of the internet. It protects virtually everything we do online, using codes containing hundreds of digits. Today's computers, even supercomputers, can't factor these large numbers with any kind of efficiency.
It would take years or maybe even decades for a regular classical computer to break a code like this, but a quantum computer that is actually scalable and functional and efficient could technically have the ability to break RSA, perhaps trillions of times faster than a classical computer, which is really scary to a lot of the world's companies.
Companies like Google, Microsoft, and IBM are all investing in quantum computers. At the same time, these companies and others, like Cisco, are developing new security techniques to stop the possibility of quantum computing attacks.
You mentioned quantum computing. You know, it's a little hard to predict when it comes to espionage, when it comes to warfare.
Michael Hayden is the former director of the NSA and the CIA. And even he can't predict what the consequences of quantum computing will be.
So when rapid-fire machine guns arrived, it clearly favored the defense. When tanks arrived, they favored the offense. And one of the tragedies of military history is that you've got people making decisions who have not realized that the geometry of the battlefield has changed because of the new weapons. And so you have the horrendous casualties. I don't know whether quantum computing will inherently favor the offense or inherently favor the defense when it comes to encryption, security, espionage, and so on. But I do know it's going to affect something.
One reason Hayden can't put his finger on how future tech will affect warfare is because cyberspace is still relatively new as a domain for war.
We still argue over the laws of armed conflict at sea, and we've been in the maritime domain for millennia. And so now we're arguing about what of our experience in the physical domains, the ones created by God, transfers well to the digital domain. What constitutes an armed attack? What constitutes an act of war? What's the line between espionage and something else? The debates continue. It really is unsettled.
Ann Hayden says these unanswered questions may jeopardize U.S. security.
In a strange way, that punishes a country like the United States. Because even though we have great power, and here I'm talking about great cyber power, we're actually a law-abiding nation. And we've not yet figured out a lot of the important questions with regard to law and policy. So there are a lot of things we could do that we don't do because of these questions remaining unanswered. It doesn't apply to some other countries. This offers opportunities for folks to create effects. It's the dark side of the coin for which we have it in the first place. Speed, usability, ubiquity. I mean, all those things are virtues until you think about them in the hands of someone who wants to do you harm, and then they're tremendous disadvantages.
But could these disadvantages lead to a national catastrophic cyber attack? Maybe. But that possibility doesn't keep him, or Endgame CEO Nate Fick, up at night.
I don't like the stories about a cyber 9/11 or a cyber Pearl Harbor. I think that's actually a distraction. It gets us focused on the big flashing red light event that is probably a low probability event. The great risk of cybersecurity is this sort of creeping erosion of our confidence in the digital domain. In an era when all of us are so reliant on the connected world for commerce, for education, for communication, for entertainment, you know, it's infused with everything we do.
Fick says the future of cybersecurity is really about which nation can get to the finishing line first.
Cybersecurity is a technology arms race. And, you know, in the same way that offense and defense are an arms race, attribution and obfuscation are an arms race. And you build a 12-foot wall and the attacker builds a 14-foot ladder.
Yeah, what we've learned today about cybersecurity is that there are always going to be smart people who know the ins and outs of computing and of hacking and of attacking.
Again, the Wall Street Journal's Sarah Castellanos.
It's basically going to be a race between us and our adversaries about who will be on top of hacking and who will be on top of actually securing our internet infrastructure. So even in the era of quantum computing, there is a risk that some adversary will develop some technology that could even attack a quantum-resistant algorithm.
No company, no single company can see all of the threats that are in cyberspace all of the time. No single government can see that, not even the U.S. government.
Former White House cybersecurity advisor Michael Daniel.
The only way to really understand what the adversaries are doing and build up our understanding of how the adversaries are doing it so that we can actually figure out the right ways to disrupt them systematically and not just continue to try to plug the holes in the dike or, you know, play a game of whack-a-mole every time they pop up. The only way to do that is to ensure that we're actually sharing the information about what the adversaries are doing amongst all of the defenders. And we need to be doing that at a scale that is commensurate with the scale of the internet and at a speed that is commensurate with the speed of the internet.
And he says so much of this still comes back to an essential concept, the password.
You can go to 1982, one of the Star Trek movies, The Wrath of Khan. Because they didn't change the default password, Captain Kirk and Spock were able to hack the Reliant and make use of the default password.
Reliant's prefix number is 16309.
I don't understand.
Each ship has its own combination code
to prevent an enemy from doing what we're attempting.
there are many of the precursors going back a long way that expose some of the problems that we're dealing with in cybersecurity now. Those are kind of funny anecdotes, but I think they really do highlight the fact that these problems are not entirely new. They are expressed in some new ways through cyberspace, but a lot of the underlying issues have actually been with us for quite some time.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Garrett Crowe. We had help from Robert McMillan, Stephen Rosenbusch, and Sarah Castellanos. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. John Wurdock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. Make sure to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong from The Newsroom in New York.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.